podcast.
Hello, my name is Luis Cronopio. I'm a master's student of culture and environment in Africa in the University of Cologne. And today I'm here with Professor Gerrit Dimmendaal, who is a professor here at the Institute and an expert in color. Let me ask you, Gerrit, I don't know if that's too philosophical, but can we define color? Can you say what is color?
Yes, I think if you ask specialists in medicine, they'll give you one definition of color, namely the reaction in our brain where we apparently have receptors for specific colors like yellow and red and a few others. So the answer side of biologists would be, if you show people certain color chips like the Munsell color chart, you get an answer, this is green, this is blue, etc., depending on the language you are using. However, if you then try and use the same method proposed by people in medicine and specialists of biology, travel around the world and then do the same tests, you get some surprising things to see. The biomedical side helps to some extent in, for example, observing that certain so-called colors are more prominent than others, but it leaves us with a range of problems where no biologist or specialist in medicine can help us. And this is where it becomes interesting, because this is a phenomenon that is widespread across the world. So if we want to understand what human beings are doing when they are using their cognitive system, we apparently have to take other phenomena into account, and the abstract label attached to that is cultural or cultural significance.
And what variants in the cultural they are influence this perception in color?
Yes, I think ever since Lenneberg and Brown in the 1950s and later on Berlin and Kay, many people have claimed that culture doesn't matter. It's a purely physical thing. All human beings distinguish between colors, and we have a certain hierarchy, and culture doesn't matter. But ever since Berlin and Kay, 1969, hundreds and hundreds of studies have appeared showing that there is more going on, and that this so-called hierarchy in the perception of color is not as restrictive and strict as the protagonists of this model would like it to be. And the question is, why is that so? To me, this is an indication that it's in the nature of human language. Of course, we have our cognitive constraints, but apparently we as human beings have a lot of freedom. Even with these cognitive constraints, we can manipulate meanings, we can do things, and still nobody, as long as you are a member of that community, nobody there gets confused. Just yesterday we had a class on anthropological linguistics with new students, and I showed them a picture of a lady with a certain hair color, and I asked the students to describe the color of the hair of this lady. The student from Indonesia said brown. A student from Germany said, no, that's red. Because as a speaker of German, she learned that when we're talking about certain material, for example, hair, there are certain shades that other people might call brown in their language, but in German and Dutch and English, the label is red. Because you have to learn, it's not just an abstract notion. You have to learn to which material is this this term attached.
And to what extent these different opinions can become problematic or very problematic in the interaction between people, cultures?
Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. Again, I told the students that in Sudanese Arabic, there are people who are green. They have a green color, and they're not from Mars. In Sudanese Arabic, people with a very dark black complexion are referred to, or their skin color is referred to as green. And to an outsider, this may sound strange, but in the end, it's nothing different. It's the same phenomenon as in English, where, for example, Barack Obama would describe himself as a black person. It's not the kind of black you see on the blackboard. It has to do with skin colors. And this, again, is the same phenomenon. We can manipulate meanings, and as long as it's conventionalized in the society, as long as other people know what we are talking about and what kind of material we are referring to, there's no problem in communication. The problem starts once you translate these concepts, and once you enter another speech community, then you may get some funny misunderstandings. Sometimes also between partners with different first languages, they may disagree about the description of certain things, because one is a speaker of Portuguese and the other one is a speaker of English, for example. And we see the same thing, and still we don't see the same thing.
And there's, for example, this small bottle that I have here, I see it green.
Yes.
And if someone comes here and says to me that it's yellow, I would say this person has problems in vision.
Yes.
Am I right?
It could be the case. If you speak the same language, of course, there are people who are colorblind, and then you could do tests and ask them to sort out colors which are basically the same for you as a speaker of English or Portuguese, and then one can identify color blindness. But there may be something else going on. If you were to ask a speaker of Timor, for example, a language spoken in the Nuba Mountains in Sudan, and you show them objects like the bottle, which for a speaker of English would be green, and you take another object which a speaker of English would describe as yellow, and you take another object which a speaker of English would describe as blue, a Turkana speaker would say, same. It's all he. And so now we're getting to the real problem. What does this word, in this case in Tima, he, mean? How do I translate it? I can translate it as green, yellow, blue. It's all correct. The point, however, is for speakers of Tima, at one level, this is one concept. And so maybe a better translation in the end is it's bright colored. It's not dark, it's not light, it's not red. It's this other domain. That's what the word is expressing. And apparently many people, especially in the Sahel region, where it's common not to distinguish between yellow, green, and blue, with basic, so-called basic color terms, it's quite common in that area to do that. This is enough. One can always be more specific and say it's like the color of trees, or it's like the color of the sky, etc. So there's always a way out. The point, however, is, because this is the basic assumption of Berlin and K, we should look at basic color terms. And the question is there such a thing as a basic color term completely detached from the material we are looking at? And I think my conclusion is, in many parts of the world, it isn't. You have to take the material into account. The point is, in this domain and other semantic fields in human languages, we can see something that's also common elsewhere, namely globalization. These differences will disappear. Mm-hmm. We can already see this in African languages, where English or French or Portuguese is important in the educational system. Students now tend to adopt the English or Portuguese conception of color, but also of space and many other domains. And then these other systems will disappear. And there's nothing wrong with that in principle. This is, I think, a normal phenomenon in human culture. We adapt and things change. And the point is, I think, from a scientific point of view, that is, I think, why it's important to me, is to make sure that in our so-called analysis, we should make sure we don't suffer from interference from our own cultural background, from our own perception of reality. And it's a very subtle matter, but I think social science has suffered from ethnocentric perspectives. There's a wonderful study about the so-called weird people, the white educated.
I remember from your classes.
Yes, showing that what these psychologists did, for example, in their tests, and that of course includes color, is that once you've studied this with people from Germany, maybe, and America, you know how the human mind works. My favorite word in German is Jein, ja und nein, yes and no. We know a bit more about the way the human cognitive system works, but not enough. And I think this is what they have been showing at the Max Planck Institute in Nijmegen ever since the early 90s, showing that there are interesting differences between the way we conceptualize space, color, the way we interpret nature. They're minimal, and some might say they are trivial. I don't think they are trivial because they tell us something about the way the human mind works and the way language works. And this is what we are after. This is what we want to understand.
So is it possible, like Belen and Kay proposed, to do like a universal color spectrum?
You can, huh? And this is what I myself did, because I grew up with this universalist thinking. I was fascinated by the idea that there are so many restrictions on the way we, for example, cut up the color spectrum. In the same way, I thought in those days, in the 1980s, there are many other restrictions in human language. This was the time when universalism was flowering, and we thought, or scientists thought, there are very strong restrictions on the way language is organized, the way our perception is organized. I think now we know that, yes, there are interesting restrictions, but many of them are more aerial in nature, that is, in certain parts of the world, people like to conceptualize things this way, in other parts of the world, in a slightly different way. But the important point, I think, is, at least this is what I learned from my own experience over the past 30 years, is knowing that there is a lot of variation. And that to me is interesting, let's say, a desire for exoticism, for showing that, look how strange this language is, or the way these people behave. That's not the point. The point is, I'm an empiricist. I want to take reality seriously. And the differences we observe tell us something about the way human thinking is organized, and probably how a culture developed. The idea is language and culture co-evolve. They're not detached from each other. Language is a flexible phenomenon, and that's probably why human beings are so successful. We can adapt the language as long as the community knows what is going on. How are we changing the meaning of words? And it is very widespread. This is how language works. And I think it only strikes us in another language once we notice that it's different from our own language. But basically, we're all doing this. We're manipulating meaning, whether it's in relation to color or space, which is another thing. I'm from a flat country. Anything above 1 meter is a mountain in the Netherlands. And if people here in the flat part of Cologne tell me to go up the streets, and I see it's as flat as the Netherlands, I wonder, what are people doing? Or you go down the street. Yeah. What does it mean? There is no up and down here. It's flat. But that's what human beings are doing. As long as it makes sense to them, anything goes. And I think this is the wonderful thing about human evolution. Apparently, language allows us to do this. And the differences are interesting because it probably tells us something about the different niches, the different environments where human beings lived, and they managed to use language in a way that made sense to them.
I I have a question about white and black. I've read some papers and I found very interesting this thing, this question that what is the whitest color, if you can say, or what is the blackest color? Because these two colors, they belong in the lightness or whiteness of the other colors. I don't know.
Yeah, they're achromatic, I think some would say. Yeah? So they're not really colors.
For example, if we have a red color and we can light it out with white or darken it out with black.
Yes.
What role plays white and black in the color system?
I think one of the first scientists who looked at this phenomenon of color was Geiger, a scientist from the 19th century who published and gave talks on the topic of color ever since the 1850s, I think. And he already claimed that the first thing we human beings do, he was thinking in terms of evolution, is distinguish between black and red and white. So the idea of Berlin and K, of course, it's not new. It's just an elaboration of this. But it was based on some experience, apparently, Geiger already had, that in many languages you find a term which refers to black or white in English or German, and you can always ask speakers if you have different shades of blackish, grayish tones. You ask speakers with this term which one here would be the best representative for what you call black or what you call white in your language. And that's the idea. The idea has also been picked up by Berlin and K. There are sort of the best representatives of black, white, red. But the idea was these are the first terms that pop up, and other terms follow. That's probably true. I'm not claiming there are no constraints. There are very definitely constraints. I'm just claiming they are not as rigid as some people would like them to be. And this tells us something about language, the way language works. So, yes, black and white are among the first, it has been claimed, for example, with specific groups in Papua New Guinea, that they only have two. The Dani, for example, have two so-called basic terms, which one can translate as black and white. What do they do if they want to refer to something which you or I would call yellow or red? Well, they just use other words for certain birds or clay, etc. There's always a way out. But if you like the idea of so-called basicness, then these terms are out. So the perception is there. The point is, what do people do with the perception of these colors?
And in your experience in Africa, how can you make a comparative with the Tima group, for example, and the Colon group?
Yes, I think the traditional scientific idea Berlin and K, which goes back 150 years, is you show people color chips, the so-called Munsell color chart with more than 300 varieties, and then you get the results. This is what people have been doing. Well, it's a first step. I used it myself, but then after I did that, for example, in a language I studied for my PhD, Turkana, a Nilotic language in Kenya, I used color chips and I got the Turkana terms, but did I understand the meaning of those words at that point? Not really, because once I started to apply these terms to, for example, the color of cows, which is the only domain in that culture where it makes sense to use these terms, I just made mistakes. I didn't know how to use these terms. It's the same issue as the earlier issue, red hair. When does somebody in Europe have red hair? It's not necessarily the Iroquois punk red. There are certain shapes of red for which other people would call brown, but in many European languages it's called red. And it's the same with the Turkana terms. They use the word, a word which one can translate as blue or green, but there are no green-blue cows in Turkana, and no Milka cows either. There are no pink or purple cows, but still they use these terms when talking about cattle. And so if you want to become a good speaker of Turkana, you have to learn how to apply these terms when you're talking, for example, to the color of skins. Otherwise, you're not a competent speaker. And this is the domain where I think so far no specialist for brains or somebody from medicine can tell us what's going on in the human mind. We can all do it, but these receptors don't help us. There's something else, something very complex apparently going on in our mind. And if we are not capable of understanding what's going on in our mind, I think that the physical data don't really help that much. Mm-hmm. Because it's the core of language, something we can do, the same with space and many other domains. And as far as I know, no cognitive scientist knows what's going on in the mind, but people manipulate meaning that way. Mm. But we do, we all do. The problem starts once you move from one speech community to the next. You get interesting, funny misunderstandings. Mm-hmm.
So to come to an end, do you have some suggestions, I would say, that through color we can accept or understand the other better?
Yes, I think if we sort of take this as a symbolic act, anybody who's not colorblind can distinguish between color. And languages do have words to describe phenomena which biologists would refer to as color. The point is understanding the meaning of those terms, and that is the main thing. Once you understand, or you think you understand, the way a specific meaning or a specific word in another language is being used, I think at that point one has made a major step, and one should not try and look for equal relations. It's not X equals Y, it's X is like Y, or X is like Y and Z.
So it's something like untranslatable somehow.
Yes. One can translate it, but it's complex sometimes. There's often no one-to-word relation. I asked the students yesterday in the same class, because of the discussion in the media about Heimat, which has a high frequency in the German political discussions now. What is Heimat? And they came up with different descriptions, all related, but that is exactly the point. If you try to explain to somebody who's not a speaker from this community, what does Heimat mean, feeling of being at home, if you want, like, that's one meaning, You have to describe it, and it's not different from color terms. Sometimes you can translate it directly, like red or anything else. But if you translate the Tima word, and now I'm back to where we started, the Tima word he, you can translate it as green and yellow and blue. But it's only a rough equivalent, because it basically means something which is bright, in between black and red and white. That is the real meaning. And we can do that, so there's no problem. I don't think it is worse than using translation equivalents. On the contrary, I think this is what is going on. Sometimes we have to describe the meaning in another language, and by doing that we learn about the cultural meaning of that word.
Okay, thank you very much for this insight, ideas about color.
Thank you for your kind interest.
Thank you.